So welcome to This Cycling Live. Today I'm joined by Alan Colville, who is an independent consultant. He's a dad, he's a cyclist, and he's also soon to be turning 50, a Guinness Book of Records world record holder for something which is very special in the cycling world, which is called Everesting. So welcome to you, Alan. Maybe you can give a quick introduction to yourself.
Hi there. I'm Al. Really, that's what people call me. Completed a massive world record. So it'd be I'm really keen to share just the overwhelming joy at that. But I'm Irish, as you can probably tell from the accent. I live in Bristol in the UK. We're in lockdown at the moment, like many people. And just really good to kind of get the story out there and have a chat about it.
Yeah. So, Al, can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, growing up as a kid in Ireland? Ireland is a country where people are passionate about sport, but I guess there cycling is not a dominant sport. Were you a biker as a kid? I mean, what did you do as a child when it came to athletics and sports and stuff?
Yeah, so I mean, Ireland, if you think about Ireland, it's fundamentally it's about Gaelic Athletic Association. So it's football and hurling. That's what I was brought up with. I cycled all the time. When it was raining, I'd cycle around the garage because I loved cycling. But there wasn't really any access to any cycling associations or groups or clubs around us. Although at the time, growing up in the kind of 80s, it was all Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach. I mean, cycling was massive in Ireland, but there wasn't the infrastructure there. So I went forward just playing the kind of football and hurling, and I came to a point where actually I wasn't big and strong enough to compete. So I kind of went away from the sport for a while before starting to take up soccer when I moved to the UK in 2001 and playing kind of Sunday league and really enjoying it. And then went traveling for a point with my wife and my 1.5-year-old and started running and really enjoyed that and came back into the Dublin Marathon, which is called Friendly Marathon. Really good fun, a fantastic experience. But on that traveling, I found mountain biking. I had a friend in Queenstown who put me on a mountain bike and threw me down the side of the gondola, and I hit every tree and I absolutely was hooked. So when I came back, I quite quickly started to find out more about it, talk to people about it, meet people, and then also started to compete and kind of, had found a sport that I was actually good at, having dabbled in lots. And
it's interesting you say that, because looking at you, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about your physiology? I mean, how tall are you? What do you weigh? Because I mean, to me, you look like a pretty lean, mean mountain bike kind of physique.
I think I'm a bit of a mountain goat. I'm 56 kgs, yeah. So light enough, 5'6". Pretty built for the types and stuff. So everything would come quite naturally. If you look at my training stress score for something like an Everest, it's incredibly low. And I know this because I've had friends who have Everested with me, and they've been double the training stress score for the effort that I'm putting in. So I'm pretty much built for climbing.
Yeah, absolutely. So you did have success at the national level. I mean, you did progress very rapidly for someone who came to the sport quite late. I mean, 2007, you were well into your, I guess, 30s by then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you came to sport relatively late. You did well with mountain biking, but then I understand you also had quite a setback with an accident.
Yeah, so progression was good on a good trajectory. And then 2011, just at this time of year, so nearly 10 years ago, it was the 18th of January, got hit by a truck cycling to work, and that put me out for a year on the flat of my back. It was a character building year, let's say. But looking back on that now, I have to say that lots of the things I learned in that year about myself, about my character, about the what I could do, how I could get myself back on my feet, how I could get myself back on the bike, I still draw on those things now, and I think they've helped me in my work, in my cycling as well. To kind of be stronger, to maybe go the distance, and to fall back on some of those resourcefulness and everything else you learned from coming through something as serious as that.
Yeah, because you were very seriously injured. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, you were hospitalized. There were real concerns in terms of the internal damage. You had some pretty significant damage to your muscles as well. But on top of that, I guess it was also, I mean, not just coming back for yourself mentally, it must have been also fears, created some fears or some worries with your family as well, because you have a wife and two daughters, right? I mean, how did they feel about it when you were saying you wanted to get back on the bike and start setting goals and targets for yourself again?
I think, to be honest, the driving force for me was to get back on the bike. I had a picture of me competing at the National Cross Country Series. It was on my wall, and that's what I was looking at the first time I sat on the turbo again and spun pedals. The driving force throughout that was always, I'm going to cycle again. And this is despite lots of the medical practitioners telling me that, you know, you'll never compete like that again. And actually, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that. But I think I learned maybe to listen to my own body and go with what feels right for me. And that drove me forward. But, you know, that year was a tough year because I worked for myself. I'd kind of lost my invincibility through that accident. And I'd lost my, you know, cycling for maybe, Jamie, for you and I and others who do, it's part of your story, right?
Yeah.
And that's all of a sudden just stripped away from you. I have to be really honest. There were some dark days during that year. It was tough. It was mentally really, really tough. And progress was desperately slow. But yeah. Then, you know, your first time cycling in the woods on your mountain bike is just, you know, it's transformational when you get back to it. And that drives you on to the next thing. Yeah. But my family are absolutely, and friends as well, I've had tremendous support and continue to do to push me forward in this. It wasn't a surprise though that I was going to get back in the way. It was always there. It was always going to happen.
But I guess it is a shock. I mean, I had my own very serious accident in 2015 when I managed to break 10 of my ribs and dislocate my shoulder and puncture my lung and knock out some teeth and concussion. I was in hospital in Mallorca for about 10 days. And it was also for me about a year of recovery. But I do remember that first few rides getting back on my bike and actually the shock of how much condition I'd lost, you know, how much muscularity I'd lost. And, you know, I remember that first sort of summer back on my bike after having almost a year off and, you know, riding with my friends and getting dropped at the base of the climbs. And, you know, just, it was a horrible feeling. However, you know, for me, I did believe that I could rebuild. But it was, as you say, there were some pretty dark days there. I mean, how was that feeling for you coming back? I mean, because I think your injuries were even more serious than mine. And how did you sort of overcome that self-doubt and the also some of the words the medical practitioners were telling you about the likelihood of you coming back?
Being honest, Jamie, denial. Mm-hmm. I think I denied for a long time. I wasn't willing to accept. I'm quite belligerent. Mm-hmm. I think if you do kind of ultra endurance, you have to be a little bit belligerent, right? Yeah. And I was quite belligerent. I didn't accept for an awful long time, years, that the injuries I was carrying, so the fact I lost my right glute max, you know, the cyclist muscle, I was unwilling to accept that that could impact my cycling. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, that's okay. Because I think if you completely accept it, maybe you don't do some stuff. Maybe it stops you. Maybe it limits you. I don't think I'm in denial now. I think I've moved beyond that. And now I'm more accepting of the fact that the body can fill in so brilliantly and other muscles can contribute so well. And then you kind of, you know, you stick to the things that you are going to be good at. So for me, mountain biking is a natural fit because I'm really light. And also you don't have those long flat sections where the lack of a glute muscle can really count. So I mountain bike up and down and all around and that works. And you're using your quads, for example, to fill in and other body muscles. And yeah, so I think for me, it was a little bit of denial and just the passion to kind of continue to get back to it. To cycling, and then the idea that, well, I'm back cycling now. What else could I do? How far could I push this? And you just keep going.
Yeah. So that was part of the journey. So 2013, 2019, you were coming back slowly, and then getting back into competition, and then 2020, the pandemic hit, and you came up with this new challenge, this new goal for yourself. And can you talk to us about that, about how that new idea with regard to the Everesting challenge came up, and then why to go for a world record?
Yeah, it started in December 2019. I did my first Everest with a friend to kind of commemorate it. A charity event that we had done the year before, which was 10 riders cycling the coast of the UK in 20 days. And this was just to commemorate it. But I did my first Everest and it was a tough one. It was in winter, middle of winter. It rained, took 17 hours. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was brilliant. Now, three of us started that day and I was the only one that finished because it was just nasty in the wind and actually it was on a busy hill in Wales. And that was the first Everest. And then, you know, January came and then, you know, the world changed essentially. But everything was still possible for me locally on a hill on my own. It was quite a solo challenge. So I did another one in January, and then I found I did another one in February. And then, of course, you have to do an indoor one, right?
So for those uninformed, for those who are novices to the term Everesting, can you just explain to us what is Everesting, where's it come from, and how it's actually evolved now into actually a sort of global phenomenon?
Well, it's a very simple idea, and I think that's why it's evolved so well. And I think particularly it's evolved, you know, last year, because it's a solo challenge that you can do. And essentially all you do is you do repetitions of the same hill from top to bottom. So that's kind of the rules, essentially. And you do it until you get the equivalent height to Mount Everest, which is 8,848 meters. So it's tough, you know. That's a huge amount. I mean, most cyclists wouldn't have hit anything near the kind of 9,000 meters in one cycle. And Hell's 500 run it. They're in Australia, and Andy and the group will, you know, once you do it and you submit your data, they'll put it on their site and you're in their Hall of Fame. It's really cool, actually. And it's kind of grown from there, and it's become a global thing. And, you know, lots of cyclists want to do it. It's something that, you know, you couldn't just go and do. It takes an element of training and preparation, and, you know, maybe a couple of goes and maybe building to it. But the sense of achievement in having done an Everest, it's conceptually, it's just the height of Everest. We all kind of, it's just that aspirational thing that's just wonderful. So, yeah it's and particularly during lockdowns and the way the year went last year, it's become much more popular, and it's really good, really good fun. And
I mean, you're making me feel jealous, you know, because I live in Flanders in Belgium, and I don't think we have a hill that would be even close to being repeatable enough to do Everest. I'd probably have to do 1,000 repeats or something on the little molehills we have here in Flanders. But so that then evolved into the identification of the world record, the Guinness Book of Records record. So can you talk us a little bit about that, about how that idea came up, and then maybe talk to us about how you approached that, because of course you had a first attempt which didn't work out, and then eventually the successful attempt.
So I kind of realized, and it's simple, I'm efficient at climbing. So then in Everest wasn't the, you know, it was a big challenge for me to do the first one. But then as I did the second, it became more efficient. My planning, my logistics became better, my nutrition, and my performance and pacing became better, because I'm a racer. Okay. I'm, you know, the gun goes, I'm off. But this is very different to that. If you try to race in Everest, you're not going to get very far. So it's about pacing. But for me, there was transformational moments last year where doing my first double Everest, and I did it indoors because we were in lockdown time. So you use Zwift, and it was Alpe d'Huez that I used for it. But there was a transformational moment. So it took me 24 hours to do a double Everest indoors. So a couple of things. First time ever going through the night at a challenge. So that was new ground. But also I was doing it with a teammate of mine. So I ride for a team called Team JMC, and I was doing it with Matt Jones. And I was doing the double, and he did a single Everest at the end from his living room. But in the final climb at the bottom, he messaged me and said, "You'd never get an opportunity to empty the tank like this and just to see what's in it." And that was this amazing moment where I was pushing out 5 watts, 6 watts, 7 watts per kilogram up after 23 hours of doing this. And that was just this eureka of, you know, the final sprint. I'd never tapped into a final sprint that much to see what's possibly in there. And of course, once that was done, and I spoke to Matt actually fired up the idea of, because he looked at my training stress score and his was double mine. And he was going, "Jesus, this, you know, you have some latent ability here to climb." And then the idea of the world record came up, and it was set by a chap called Craig Cannon in California on a sunny day on a 12% average hill that was lovely and straight with great surface. We don't have that here in the UK. We've got none of that. So, you know, the longest hill you could get with a straight line. So then it became very much about, well, if we're to do this, we've got to find the right hill. We spotted one in Wales, but Wales were in lockdown, so I couldn't go see it for a long time. And I really wanted to ride it to feel the hill and feel what it was like. But that turned out to be the hill. It was a 9% average hill. And the kind of balance with a fast Everest is, if you go steeper, you're going to do less kilometers and you're going to go faster, right? if you don't go as deep, so 9%, 8%, you're going to do a lot more kilometers to get your meters. So I ended up doing 80 kilometers more than the current record holder, actually, because his 12% far beat my, what turned out to be just 10% because I picked a section. But yeah, so it was kind of doing the double allowed me to kind of see what was in the tank and what more I had left, even though I thought I was tired. And then there was another transformational moment where I did my first outdoor and it took me 30 hours. But again, I learned that I could go through the night. I took a 20-minute nap in the middle of that as well at 2 a.m. And yeah, that was transformational as well, where you go, I only need 20 minutes sleep here and I'm good to go for another 8-10 hours. So it's these little kind of moments where you push yourself beyond where you normally go and it suddenly opens up this eureka of, hang on a second, you know, I've been slacking because actually my final sprint is much bigger, or I can go through the night and I can still be okay with a little nap. So that's what led to this a really serious attempt by amateurs at a world record.
Yeah. And then you did have the team together. So you came in then to the successful attempt. And can you just talk to us briefly about that experience? I mean, from arriving in Wales and being there with the guys who were supporting you, because it wasn't also just you and your bike, of course, and the team who were handing you some food and water. I mean, there was also some pretty strict technical requirements around recording the ride and having all that, you know, compliant for the Guinness Book of Records. But can you just talk to us very briefly about that experience? Because what we will share with people after this interview is the article that you published on it. And of course, you're working on your book, which they can then go and order later. But perhaps just talk us through the experience of being there with the guys and going through the experience. And were there moments where you thought you were not going to make it? Mm-hmm. When were the moments when you realized it was in reach?
Yeah, so you know, firstly, thank you to Matt and Bud. They were the team. We were still in lockdown. We were not meant to be in groups. So it was a tiny little team. And those boys actually stayed up for the 48 hours. So there was 3 endurance events going on that day. But the first 12 hours, the psychology was very simple, Jamie. We had to chunk it up, because if you start a 48-hour challenge and just think about that, it's too much. You can't take it on. So from practice and training, I worked out that I work well in 4-hour chunks. So chunked it up into 4 hours, and 4 hours became 12 hours. And 12 hours was the first Everest, went smoothly. 24 hours was through the first night, and the second Everest went fine. But the wheels came off at 2:30 on the second night. Now, the second night was always going to be, I'd never done the second night, so it was brand new. And it was always going to be tough. And I remember it was 2:30 on the second night. I had been hallucinating for probably 30, 40 minutes. I thought I was in an animation. And I just desperately needed to stop and I was fatigued, basically. So I came into the pit and chatted to the guys, told them I didn't want to stop, but something had to change. And Matt brilliantly said, right, let's just have a quick micro nap. So just 5 minutes. So I literally didn't change anything, didn't take out any lid down, 5 minutes, you know, stream of colors behind my eyes. But my breathing started to kind of slow down. And then after 5 minutes, up some hot food. And there was this moment where the guy said, the color came back in my face. And for me, the color came back in my vision as well. I was back on it. Now, the 4 hours after that, so from kind of 40 to 44 hours, were the toughest I've ever had on a bike, because we were behind the record. The record was gone. Okay. So I had to stabilize and get back to good laps. But then the sun came up, and, you know, put it on your bucket list. I'd encourage everybody to ride through a night and see the rejuvenating power of those blue rays. And then the last 4 hours of that record attempt are four of the happiest hours of my life. It was pure exhilaration. It was a final sprint of 4 hours. It's a huge final sprint. I kept asking my body for more. It just kept on giving. It was unbelievable, and it left me afterwards obviously overjoyed and overwhelmed, but also again with the kind of, you know, the untapped possibility of what we can do by going longer. You start to see that, you know, we are actually better than we think we are. We can do much more than we think. And it was a very transcendental morning that led to first getting the record and then surpassing it, and then finishing obviously exhausted and elated, but just completely overwhelmed with what had happened. And that kind of connection I've made with my body during particularly that last 4 hours, where you're just so in tune, you're, that state of flow is absolute. You would not rather be anyplace else. And it isn't, because I think there's a misconception about ultra endurance, that it's just about pain. I think there's another side, the other end of that, where it's about absolute joy and exhilaration that you carry through into your life. And I'm still, when I talk about it, I kind of well up, because it's such a transformational and life-changing thing that affects my work and my family and myself and my confidence. But critically for me, it kind of, that world record and finishing that line that day, it kind of, it put to bed the accident, finally. I wasn't defined by, you know, the lack of glute or anything like that. I was defined by my own ambition. You know, what am I going to do next? That defines me. So it was a really life-changing thing, and absolutely overwhelming and amazing to have done.
Well, it's amazing to hear you speak this way, Al, because, you know, many of the viewers that we have on TCL are juggling a career, a family, and of course their sporting passion. And now, I guess one of the messages that we continuously send to people is that it's never too late for you to come into this beautiful sport of cycling. You know, whether it's coming back from an injury or it's coming back from a long hiatus away from the sport, it's possible. And the other thing, which I think is very interesting that you've talked about here, is that you obviously have an incredible world-class athlete within you, right? And those talents were perhaps not even realized for many, many years of your life. And so I think one of the inspiring things I'm hearing from you is that here is a guy who perhaps, you know, wasn't really even fully aware of his athletic potential until he was well into his 40s in this case, you know, almost 50. So for me, that's a very inspiring story. I mean, what words would you have for people who are coming to the sport late or are maybe feeling self-doubt about setting themselves? Because you set yourself not a goal, you set yourself an Everest and a multiple Everest kind of goal, which was a world record. So what messages would you give to people who are thinking about bringing that athlete, you know, out of themselves or discovering their inner potential?
So I think for me, the cycling community is a great bunch. No matter, you know, where you are. So I think you can fast track to kind of to smart by just talking to people. So I continually did that all of last year, because I wasn't doing ultra endurance stuff before this. So it was all new. But, you know, I chat to anybody. And, you know, I chatted to Mark Beaumont, for example, the round the world record holder. He's just so open and giving of his expertise and his time, because I guess if you're coming to something late, you have that sense of I'm kind of behind here, I've got to make up. But you can fast track to smart by just talk to people, just research a bit, just try and understand. And there's always clubs and stuff, you know, local clubs and kind of people you can kind of, you know, join in with to move you along. And I guess there is that thing that if you cycle with people that are better than you, it's always better because you're going to get better. So I think that just talking and asking people and looking for help and kind of trying to get answers rather than just trying to figure it all out yourself. And it just takes so much time and it doesn't help with your confidence. You can just, so I did an awful lot of that to kind of help me get up to speed, because I kind of knew I had an amount of time to do the record attempt. I pretty much knew, because September is when I did it, and I knew if it went to October, November in the UK, the weather, I knew there was another lockdown coming. So it was kind of a tight timescale to get it done. And I also knew if I go through a winter, maybe I haven't got that same level of fitness to go into it and the ambition to do it the following year. So I needed to just chat to people and kind of fast track to that. But I do think, you know, I'm 50 in April, but I don't feel, you know, I think physically and there's a lot. Yeah, you don't comply to other people's expectations of what you should do for your age. That's really important, because you're you. Things that work for you will, you know, you just got to find them out. They might not work for other people. But yeah, set your own kind of ambition and goal and don't be led too much by what you should and shouldn't be doing at age or circumstance, because actually, yeah, if you're passionate about something, you want to go for it, then you go for it and you don't kind of listen, because that's what you want to do. So yeah, I'd say, you know, reach out for help and don't listen too much to what you should be doing. Because
we interviewed recently Dieter Vorbeck on this show. And Dieter is a former top telecoms executive, C-level executive, German, who raced as a young man, had almost 30 years away from competition. And, you know, Dieter is back living like a pro. You know, he's taken early retirement. He was offered a whole rift of board positions and new jobs. And he said, no, you know, he's returned to cycling and really setting a goal for himself again at the world level in his 60s. So, you know, our belief certainly on TCL is that it's never too late to discover that potential, but also to chase your passion. The other thing that I sense with you, Al, was just this, this incredible, what you said, this intensity of emotion in achieving what you achieve. Now, not just in achieving the record, I think, but just everything that you went through in terms of learning about yourself and what your potential is. And look, you know, I've worked in the business school world for more than 20 years. And look, I'm not saying there's anything, how do I put it? You know, there's nothing wrong with being great in your career and, you know, signing big deals and achieving stuff in terms of, you know, growing the share price of your company or IPOing your venture or whatever it might be. But for me as an athlete, there's nothing that matches it. You know, there's nothing in those other areas in terms of the business world that for me personally would match, I guess, what you've described. I mean, what's your take on that? Because you've been an entrepreneur for a big part of your life. You've also been successful in business. Can you compare the two in terms of this intensity of motion?
I'm not sure if it's comparable because I don't think that's a fair. They're not comparable things. But what I can say is digging deep, the learning from not just the record, but the process of getting there. I would describe myself, I'm a designer, so I would describe myself before this kind of the ultra endurance stuff. I wasn't a great finisher, but it was loads of ideas, right? But I had to become a very good finisher and attention to detail and planning. So that will overspill into my work really, really well. So I'm not sure, you know, I'm not expecting to run a design workshop and have the same level of emotion that I had for that 4 hours of the finish of 48, because it's just completely not comparable. But there's an overspill of learning and of approach and of resourcefulness that carries through to my work really, really well, and my family as well. So I think I get as much of a kick to a different degree from the type of work stuff I do. I don't think they're comparable, but what I know is the spillover between both is really beneficial. And excluding one means it's kind of one dimensional. And I know my work is better for the stuff that I've done. But back to a point you were asking about, you know, because I think lots of people ask me, well, how did you even get the time, you know, to even do that? And I think last year, you know, we're in lockdown again at the moment, working remotely, not traveling around the country for clients, it opened up some time for me to get a little bit more time with family, which opened up a little bit more time to train. But I have to say, my training was never about lots and lots of hours. I don't do any jump runs. I'm very meticulous about that. I didn't need to ride for 24 hours to do a 48. That's not really what you need to do, because you got to learn that balance, don't you? And just be aware that, you know, it's not about just continually cycling your bike. It's every session needs to have a purpose. And if there isn't a purpose to it, then there's probably not a point in doing it. And actually, you're really wrecked. You know, don't go out and try and hammer yourself. And, you know, don't do three really hard sessions a week, because that's just kind of too many to not have a huge impact. So I think it's, how do you create the space in your life to have the headspace to take on something like a world record is what I worked really hard at. And I'm going to try to carry that forward to see where I can create the headspace to maybe do something for the 50th birthday. I think that'd be quite cool.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting to say that, I mean, obviously as a husband and a father, you've also had a few fans kind of watching what you've done. I mean, how did your wife and daughters respond to the fact that their, you know, husband and father has become a world record holder? Do you see your discipline, your commitment, your passion? I mean, is that something that that is fully appreciated by those around you?
I think it's a work in progress. I think, to be honest, the way it went was, because when we were doing the actual attempt, we didn't put it on social media because we didn't want people turning up, because we needed to keep the numbers low because of COVID and restrictions. So actually all we had was a WhatsApp group that we had people on, and I got the narrative from that. Some of it's on the blog post. It was wonderful, these messages coming from, you know, former Olympians, Ollie Beckinsale, who trains me actually, and others, just kind of. So I think it wasn't until those messages started to come through that my wife and family started to go, oh my goodness, he's actually doing this. He's 12 hours in, he's 24 hours in. And then you've got other people that know me going, you know, waking up the first morning going, hang on, Al's still cycling. And then waking up, of course, on a second morning going, is he still cycling? Yeah. So I think within, you know, my own family are used to me kind of pushing myself, they're used to the cycling thing. But yeah, the overwhelming sense of achievement and joy. And I think, that they've shared, and particularly my 16-year-old daughter, she really got it. And when she was in school the Monday morning, which is when we finished, you know, lots of messages were coming, kind of saying, how's dad doing? Has he finished? Has he got there? Has he done it? You know, and then lots of encouraging messages. So I think, to be honest, last year was, for everybody, it was a difficult year. This little moment, this record that we did, for the people that were connected to it, it really gave everybody a lift. My family, my friends, my family back in Ireland. It was just a little moment of it was just beautiful the way it worked out. And because it was, you know, the movie would be, you know, the record is gone, he lost it, and he managed to come back and recover it. And there was this huge sprint finish and falling over. It was just tough as, but incredibly, just so worth the go. So I'd encourage people just to set a challenge. If it's 10K, great, just to have a goal, because once you've completed it, that sense of accomplishment and the possibilities, the endless possibilities, starts to open up about what you could do next. It's just really, really, and that's with irrespective of age, right? That wonder is still there, whether you're 50 or whether you're 20. It's like, oh, just done that, what can I do next? And that's where I am at the moment. It's like, I've just done something that I never thought I could do. It's a childhood dream, right? We all have the Guinness Book of Records, the printed version back in our day when you were a kid, right? You get it at Christmas. To get a Guinness World Record is a complete dream. So yeah, your mind obviously moves to, what are the possibilities? Because that final sprint blew me away, as it did in that virtual Everest that I did that last sprint up. I still question now what's left in the final sprint, because we've evolved to hold on to a final sprint from chasing animals on the Serengeti or whatever. It's there, but I'd say, even to you, Jamie, do you truly know what's really left in that final sprint? Because we're so good at holding on and protecting.
Yeah. No, it's a great question, and I think, you know, talking to you, Al, there's several, you know, really profound messages in your journey. I mean, I think one of those certainly is the journey itself. You know, I think something that I've reflected on, and I guess learned for myself over the years, is that, you know, when you do set these big goals for yourself, you know, it's not so much what you get in achieving the goal, but it's what you learn along the way, you know, about yourself, about, as you said, about how you can organize your life differently, about, you know, what those relationships, you know, really do mean for you. And that's really critical here. I think so many of us are constantly, you know, setting goals for ourselves and being very focused on goals, but maybe not stopping to just enjoy and to experience that process along the way and to reflect on that. Very important one. The other one for me is, you know, you and I are a month apart in age, right? You know, you're April 71, I'm March 71. And, you know, something that I've absolutely embraced is the realization that, you know, I'm maybe only halfway there, right? Yeah. Because we're heading towards 100-year life. And so this is really just beginning for many of us, you know, whether we're in our 40s, 50s, even 60s, like Dieter Vorbeck, in many ways, the next chapter of our life is just beginning, you know? Yeah. And the chapter is there for us to write and really to jump into that. And that's also very much, I think, what I reflect upon in listening to you, is that, you know, we don't know what our potential is. You know, we don't know. And the thing that I've been amazed with, you know, having incredible advice, like you've said, reaching out to really amazing people, my coach, Alan Davis, Michael Rogers, former world champion, time trialist, who's a good friend and advisor to me, is that I still see improvements at 50 years old.
Yeah.
I don't know what that potential is, that ceiling is, and just keep pushing that. So not allowing others to tell us that because of our age or the stage we're in our life, that there are limitations. You know, yeah. I'm still racing against people who are half my age, you know, and still having success. And that's a big kick. And then finally, I think the other thing here is that something we take for granted is that, you know, we're often very much focused on what we are doing in terms of our goals and our learning and our growth as athletes or more broadly. But we can't also take for granted that there are people watching us, you know, and not just watching us in the moment of the event or the race or the attempt in your case. But, you know, I have three children who watch me every single day in terms of the way I live my life. And I'm sure that your wife, your daughters, your colleagues, I looked at LinkedIn, Al, and I was just blown away by the number of comments and words of encouragement and the inspiration that you actually had given other people. So I think that's also something we shouldn't take for granted, is that in chasing these dreams ourselves, we also have that ability to radiate that optimism and to encourage others around us.
I think that's a really good point, Jamie, and one that I should have picked up on, actually. So I remember doing the double Everest indoors in my garage, feeling like it'd be a very disconnected experience. But I also remember the messages coming through at 2 a.m. in the morning from people, or the messages coming through very early. And actually the overwhelming takeaway from that experience was that sense of connectivity with other people and that social connection, which is completely against what you would think about being on Zwift, being in a garage, in lockdown, isolated. I think the thing that has overwhelmed me this year has been that, as I said, during the record as well, that group of people and that support and that social connection that we need, you know, that drove me on hugely. You can't do these things in isolation. We're social creatures. And I think particularly this year, we've needed those outlets and ways of connecting. And this was an opportunity for people just to galvanize around something crazy that somebody's doing. And that, I think, has been my biggest takeaway, how just, you know, fundamentally good people are and how they want you to achieve and how they'll support you and offer encouragement at all times of the day and night. Because I look back through the WhatsApp group for the world record and there was maybe 30 people on it. And the times that people were messaging, they should have been asleep. But it was, just incredible support. And I'm forever grateful for that.
That's great. No, well, I mean, those people also sometimes keep your feet on the ground as well. You know, I mean, my wife, Anna Mia, I mean, I love her dearly. She's a wonderful person. She supports me incredibly. But, you know, in start of 2020, I was lucky enough to actually go off and do some real racing. You know, I went and did the UCI World Series event in Casablanca, which was one of the early qualification events for the World Championship. And, you know, I was lucky enough, I won both the time trial and the road race there for the Masters classification. And then, you know, I came home and, you know, walked into the kitchen with my medals around my neck and my, you know, world jersey on. And my wife turned to me and said, "That's lovely, darling. Can you empty the dishwasher and take out the trash? And then when you come back, let's talk about it." You know,
I've got a comparable one. My 13-year-old daughter came to watch the record and had a little placard saying "Old man finally makes it." I just thought it was perfect, absolutely brilliant to keep
you quiet. The last World Championships, actually the one before the last one, because the last one, it was in Poland, but the one before that was in Albion, France. I raced 2017. And I came in, didn't have such a great day, but I came in 30th or something like that. And then my son, who at the time was, I guess, around 10 years old, you know, and he came up to me and put his arm around me and said, "Don't worry, Dad, you know, today was not your day. But I was talking to some guys over there and they were telling me that they've just introduced the 100 plus age group classification." So he said, "Dad, you just keep trying until everybody else is, you know, kind of in the grave," I think what he was telling me. But yeah, it was good. But actually, you know, those words, Al, also I think were very important for me, and something that I also really have only come around to, I guess, in the last couple of years, is that it's also sometimes okay to take your foot off the accelerator pedal. I'm sure that when you finished that world record attempt and you achieved it, people said to you immediately, "What's next?"
And it's interesting. So
for me, you know, that's a little bit of a crazy question, because, you know, I think sometimes it's necessary for us just to pause and just to enjoy what we have done without constantly thinking about what's next. And it, even more so when we age, because as we've been talking about in this conversation, you and I have another 50 years of goals. So I think it's also necessary for us to be sometimes a little bit gentle on ourselves and those around us, because these goals are pretty taxing, actually.
Yeah, and I think this one was particularly so in terms of the evidence part of a world record is quite overwhelming. The documentation for an event that's 48 hours, you've got full video essentially that you have to provide for that 48 hours. There's all the, you know, the obvious kind of Garmin type data, but multiple versions in case one's fit. So the month afterwards were, it was quite an unusual month for me because it took a month to actually compile everything and send it in before it became an official record. And in that time, my wife turned to me at a point in that and said, "You've not finished this record." You know, she had picked up on the fact that I was still kind of in that kind of state, and that's unfair, isn't it? But and I learned quite quickly then that I needed to put it down. I needed to walk away. And I had some good friends who were, so one of my friends said to me, "Don't be the guy who immediately takes on something else big. Be the guy who can sit, can learn from what he's done, can pause essentially, as you're saying, and then move on." And I've done a lot of that thinking, and it's allowed me to kind of get to much better realizations of what I was feeling, what learnings I actually had, than just going headstrong into the next thing. So I think absolutely. And then you're right, that kind of helps in terms of our age as well. But there's something else. I think one of the learnings I've learned in terms of how to not combat the fact that I'm nearing 50, but diet for me became such an important thing. So I'm plant-based and I'm a celiac as well. And actually, I think that's helped my recovery quite a bit. I recover really fast still. Now, that's probably contrary to what you would read about, you know, when you get older and the powers of recovery. And also during this process, so I come from a cross-country kind of racing and, you know, sport nutrition in the form of gels and stuff is standard. But actually, during the course of this, I learned to not use that stuff at all. And I'm not saying whether it doesn't work for other people. I'm not making a judgment on whether it's right. But for me, to ensure that I could do a 48-hour where I was riding for 46 hours and not happen what happens in 50% of ultra endurance, which is stomach issues, I went completely natural. I kept complex carbs going for as long as possible, not simple carbs, and I avoided gels. I had one gel in the last hour, and it was all it had no effect. It was already buzzing, and I didn't need it. It was just kind of for the fun of it. I don't know. But I guess the point there is, you eat for that day well, knowing that you'll be better the next day. So my recovery is very well by just sticking to a very natural plant-based diet. I'm obviously celiac, so I avoid gluten. So I think that the quality of the food you take during that event means you can just go longer. And that's really massively important, because if you get that wrong and you have stomach issues, you know, I didn't get this record in the first attempt. The first attempt I did fail after 12 hours. It was a ridiculously hot day for the UK. It was the hottest two consecutive days, but I had real stomach issues. So I had to go away, kind of rethink everything and think differently about my preconceived ideas based on what had been marketed to me about what is good in terms of nutrition. But that was one of the really big takeaways. I don't need to supplement my performance with gels and stuff. If I stick to good natural food, then that will get me 48 hours with power. So that's a massive one for me. So I go into next year thinking, okay, let's keep the food natural and kind of what I fancy and is tasty. And let's keep going in that way, because that suits me now. And it helps with my recovery as well, not to put my stomach in a kind of a state of distress from lots of kind of gels and stuff. So yeah, it's a big learning for me from this one.
Yeah. Great. Alf, well, great to talk to you. And I think, you know, throughout this conversation, you know, I've been reflecting on some words that are shared with me a little while ago by a terrific guy, Bernard Mortemann, who often interviews on TCL. And, you know, one thing that Bernard always says, you know, because he worked over the years, he had a cycling center in Belgium where he brought in young talents from all over the world. He worked with more than 1,000 young talents over a period of more than 20 years. And, you know, one of the things that Bernard always says is that, you know, you don't have to be great to start, but you have to start to become great, you know. Yeah. And throughout the story, listening to you, I mean, it's really, you know, I think the perfect case study in that philosophy that, you know, you came to the sport late, you discovered that you had talent. You weren't great when you started, but over this period of around 13 years, you've certainly discovered the potential that you have and followed your heart and your self-belief to achieve some pretty amazing things. Yeah. So, Al Colville, it's been fantastic having you on This Circling Life. For those of you who've been watching, of course, if you've enjoyed the conversation, please do give us the thumbs up and subscribe to the YouTube channel. And Al, we absolutely look forward to reading that book of yours, which will be coming out, I hope, before too long. So Al Colville, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Jamie. Take care.